The podcast What's Left of Philosophy reviewed the model of a participatory economy in a recent episode. What did they think? What did they get right? What did they miss? We'll review their review in this episode of Pep Talk.
Could you please tell us what you see as the alternative?
Self-management, democratic control of communities or workplaces, federal arrangements.
Participatory democratic planning.
Jobs have a mix of empowered your nested councils linked to one another. Everyone gets to participate in a primary council.
Welcome to Pep Talk, the podcast where we discuss the democratic alternative to capitalism, known as a participatory economy.
Hello and welcome to Pep Talk, the participatory economy podcast, the podcast where we discuss the democratic alternative to capitalism known as a participatory economy. I'm your host, Mitchell Stepanchik, coming from Chicago. I am joined by two guests. First, Robin Hanel, joining us from Portland, Oregon in the United States. He is an economist, writer, scholar, activist, the co-inventor of the model of a participatory economy. His most recent book is called A Participatory Economy. Robin, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
We are also joined from Helsinki, Finland, with Antti Jauhainen. Antti is a longtime advocate of the participatory economy model, also a scholar, also a teacher, and also a friend of the show. Antti, welcome.
Glad to be here.
And speaking of podcasts, it turns out that the model of a participatory economy was the subject of a recent episode of another podcast. What's Left of Philosophy is a podcast by four philosophers who talk about left politics and the left theory more broadly. They devoted an episode of their podcast, What's Left of Philosophy, for folks who are interested. The episode is episode number 76, which you can find online from the website of the podcast, leftofphilosophy.com. You go there and look it up. You can find it there. Episode number 76 is called For and Against Participatory Economics. And they spend about an hour talking about the model and giving their takes with regards to it. The folks involved with this, the list of names involves Owen Glenn Williams, William Paris, Lillian Cherchia, I hope I got that last name right, and Gil Morejon. Those are the four folks who are part of the podcast, and they talked about the model of a participatory economy. And the podcast is pretty widely heard, from what I understand. Robin and Antti, you two have listened to the episode, as have I, and we're going to talk about their review of the model of a participatory economy in this episode. We'll start off by having first a general take of what you thought of their take of the model. Robin, let's start with you, co-inventor of the model. You heard them talk about the model. What do you think of their take?
Well, first of all, I'm very happy that people like them are doing a podcast about the model. That's wonderful and good in and of itself. Also, I'd like to thank them because I think that they did a respectful and serious, you know, they treated the proposal both with seriousness. They looked into it, and they treated it in a respectful way. And then, perhaps not surprisingly, they clearly indicate they liked some parts and talked about what they liked. They were skeptical that, you know, about whether some of the things we've proposed would be practical or possible. And then there were a few things they didn't like or found themselves, you know, uncomfortable with. And I suspect that that is similar to the reaction that many people coming to the model the first time have. So I think it's a really useful, I think it'd be very useful for us to engage with those three different elements that they brought out.
Antti, what was your take of their take of the model?
Yeah, I liked it as well. Maybe one of the main things that sort of stood out to me was, I think it was the end of the episode, I sort of was happy to hear that they recognized that the model has value as an example, that, you know, there is a model that can be used to discuss these issues of, you know, post-capitalist economy. And it can provide, you know, as the whole episode actually proved, that it can provide, you know, insightful discussions on things such as remuneration. The other thing maybe is that, and then the other thing is that it's just wonderful that they're doing their podcast, because this brought their podcast to my sort of view, and it's just a sort of tremendous sort of informative work that they're doing. So that was nice. But maybe the one thing, maybe it just tells something how cynical I've always been. But the first time I sort of, you know, came upon the model 20 years ago or so, was that, you know, obviously it isn't perfect. And once I, for example, got to know Michael and Robin a bit more closely, I sort of realized, yeah, this ain't gonna be perfect. But the thing is that that's kind of a silly approach in general to, you know, for visions of society to find, you know, the perfect society. But to me, it has always seemed, you know, credible enough, sensible enough, that there really is something in there, that there this could actually sort of go beyond capitalism in a sort of, to my viewpoint, in a realistic way. And I'm, you know, a huge proponent of utopias. But I think the participatory economy model hits kind of a sweet spot between utopia and realism, between, you know, revolution and reforms. And I've always liked that. That said, I mean, that's why I sort of always feel uncomfortable when people are, you know, well, and we can get back to this, but pinpoint out that, wait a second, this model actually has a problem here. And then I'm like, you know, what's the point? Are you looking for a perfect model? But I mean, of course, there are problems, and it's good to discuss them. Yeah, that's good.
Auntie, I'd like to just, you know, state for the record, you were correct when you came across the model first in your youth 20 years ago, or maybe even more. It wasn't perfect, but of course now it is.
Yeah, of course.
Because we've definitely answered all the questions that anybody could possibly.
You made the last fixes last night, and then you're like, "Damn, it's done."
That's right. And the other thing I would have just mentioned, they said that apparently you can request them to do, you know, to do a podcast on a particular subject, and they mentioned that it was Travis Froberg who had written them or even paid $20 if they would consider it.
Yeah.
And I would just like to thank Travis Froberg for having prompted them to do their podcast on a participatory economy.
Right. No, they like a lot of podcasts, they work on a subscription model where patrons from a service like Patreon will offer money to provide support, but also get some, you know, extra goodies along the way. And also they could provide ideas for suggested episodes. And this was apparently how this episode happened. So yeah, our thanks to Travis, and we'll send a reimbursement check in the mail for him regarding how much he paid for them to talk about this.
I'd like to point out that's four philosophers there who figured out a good financial model to get paid to do this. And here I am, an economist, and I'm getting paid nothing for this. And clearly there's something wrong. I have to rethink this.
We're working on that.
Okay.
I'll give a little bit of my take on the episode. Kind of echoing the sense of, it's great that they talked about it. It's great that they tried to take it seriously. It's great that they brought in other, like, they gave shout outs to a lot of other models, and also understanding, like, it's hard to come up with new ideas, especially for a realm which has long been devoid of, like, new original ideas in this realm. I mean, there's a line, it's like, Robin, you probably know this reference. Was it like Keynes, John Maynard Keynes, who said that's like, we're befuddled when we try to come up with, like, we hate capitalism, but we're befuddled when we try to come up with an alternative. Words to that effect.
Yeah. Yes, that's a great, it's a wonderful Keynes quote that very few people know of.
And it's what came to my mind when they were talking about this. They gave that due respect and understanding, you know, this is hard work. If you think you can do this, try it. And even like people who have worked in this for a long time are hard pressed to try to do this. So I'm glad that they gave the shout out for that. I'll mention a couple of big points I had with regards to their take on it. It felt like the assessment of the model was both incomplete and also in kind of easy for me to say, because I've been working on this a lot in the last like 6 or 7 years with Robin in particular, on the computational applications of the model. It felt old and it felt incomplete. They, in part of the description of their take of the episode, they cited three references. Two of them were actually publications that Robin had written with Michael Albert, the other co-inventor of the model, in the journal Science and Society, dated to 1992 and 2002. The third reference was actually the book published last year called A Participatory Economy, but it sounded to me like they didn't read that, because it's like they would have probably talked about other aspects about it, especially where some of the newer concerns regarding the model and trying to fill in those gaps that people have talked about that book just clearly outlines and sometimes even debuts. They didn't talk about that. But also, aside from that, even with the classic version of the model where you talk about the five values, which they described in some degree of completeness, not authenticity. They got it right with what they described: justice, democracy, solidarity, efficiency, and diversity. The more or less five of the planks. A sixth one for environmental concerns could be a sixth one. But as far as describing the actual institutions, four of the classic ones, balanced jobs, remuneration per effort and sacrifice, self-managed worker and consumer councils, and participatory planning, they didn't mention the balanced job aspects at all in the episode, and they only very briefly touched on the allocation mechanism, participatory planning. And it just felt like, if you're going to talk about the model, at least talk about the whole model, at least in some capacity. And I just felt like they just didn't do that. But anyway, yeah.
I agree with you that, I mean, in particular, when they were talking about the annual planning, they expressed some skepticism about whether or not, we propose that worker councils make proposals, that consumer councils make proposals, and that they then have to revise their proposals until they come to a feasible plan. Now, that's a very, very general, broad outline of the actual procedure we've proposed. I mean, it's an accurate overall assessment. And they expressed they expressed some skepticism, but would that really work and how long would it take? And well, we've spent years now, you know, recognizing that's a legitimate question. And, you know, and that's why we've spent years, as Mitchell knows, doing simulations to see whether or not, you know, and it seemed like that all that part of our work that has had very positive results. That basically is as to this point, you know, seems to demonstrate that within the month of December, it wouldn't be that difficult, you know, for the proposals and the revisions to take place to come up with an annual plan. They didn't seem to be aware of any of that. And that would be part of what we would have in a conversation with them. If they were here on the podcast, we would talk with them about that.
Right.
And, you know, in our attempt to sort of overcome their doubts on that subject.
That's also mentioned in the book, A Participatory Economy, that it's not talked about in as great a detail as the original publication, another book called Democratic Economic Planning, but it's there in the book. And if they had read the book, which they cited as a reference, you would think they would mention it or maybe just even touch on it briefly.
No, and the other thing is, but I don't want to sound too critical of them, because this is a very common thing, right? That anybody coming to the model for the first time, this is exactly the kind of reaction they're going to have. Mm-hmm. But I mean, parts 4 and 5 of the most comprehensive book, and you're right, there were also versions of this in A Participatory Economy, are talking about something that really is totally different from the annual planning procedure and the replacing markets with annual planning. It's talking about long-run environmental planning, long-run investment planning, and all those things need to be done for various reasons in ways that are somewhat different and in addition to the annual planning. And I think it's simply not uncommon for people coming to the model and reading something about it, you know, not to really see, well, we actually have addressed a host of other issues, you know, that you can be skeptical about it, but it's not like we haven't had the same skepticism and doubts ourselves and mm-hmm. and actually proposed some things in response.
Right. I wanted to play a couple of clips from the episode in regards to a couple of points that they raise. And Robin and Antti, I'd like to get your take on it. We will start with one related to payment. The remuneration norm within the model of a participatory economy is that of payment for effort and sacrifice tempered by need. It's the official statement of that. And they, well, first off, they describe it and then they complain about it. Let me play a couple of clips from that and then we'll talk about that. So we're going to start with the first clip.
Are the great distributors of reward? So who will evaluate our productive efforts under participatory planning? That's the key question. Well, it's participatory, so coworkers would be the judges of our efforts, our effort level, rather than, say, bosses or owners. As they put it, quote, while measurement will never be perfect, there is no better way to judge efforts than by a jury of fellow workers who serve on an effort rating committee on a rotating basis.
Then there's a second clip where they're talking about the complaints about the model. We're going to bring that up.
Here's talk about a couple of things. One of them is like a logistics question. And this is kind of like spontaneous, I have to admit, but I'm not sure if we really want to be like constantly weighing in on the efforts of our peers. And I'd like to like ask you guys to
sort of you're talking about me. I love the tenure process. Let's go.
Maybe in grad school where I could just have my fellow grad students evaluate my performance, you know, in terms of conversations at the bar or something. But I don't know. So, yeah, this idea of like constantly weighing the efforts of our peers, going to multiple meetings, I would assume, weekly to discuss aspects of, you know, problems that pertain both to production and to our collective social consumption. I'm curious what you guys have to say about that.
So, yeah, they're complaining about payment and particularly the norm and the mechanism for which you would determine payment, which would be, as has been proposed in instances of the model or a suggestion of it, effort rating committees, as it's called. But you've heard what they talked about it. Antti, Robin, what do you think?
I can chime in first because I was just thinking, I would love to have someone who is like, yeah, that sounds actually wonderful. I mean, I really love workplaces where everyone is constantly evaluating everyone, like on a day-to-day basis, because that's sort of a debating sleight of hand that they use, that they frame it in that way, that they, you know, make an obvious situation where, you know, I don't know, some random Maoist in 60s China might barely agree with that proposal. That's not a good start, but I would love to hear from someone who is like enthusiastic about, hey, that's, you know, wonderful, there's like, you know, hallways going above workplaces where, you know, someone can crawl and check on everyone working and so on.
This is an issue that has been raised by many people over and over and over again. And part of it comes from people are imagining themselves in our economy, and they're trying to figure out if they're going to like it. And that's good. When somebody proposes that we should do something in a certain way, you ought to, one of the things you need to do is put yourself in that situation and ask, well, would I really like this? Even if my political philosophy, you know, and my best self, you know, thinks this is a great idea, but would I really enjoy it? The thing is that if they look carefully at what we propose, first of all, we say, we think you can make a very, very strong philosophical argument that that's what's fair. And then we also say that, you know, even amongst leftists, I mean, leftists have argued for, you know, for over 100 years now, for 200 years, about exactly what's fair. And it's been a primary thing that leftists have, and it would be foolish, in our opinion, and we have made this very clear, in our opinion, it would be foolish to assume that everybody was in agreement on that when the new economy goes into operation. Not everybody's going to agree on that. So we're very, very careful to say that it's up to workplaces to decide how to go about this. And, you know, and we even talk about the fact that, well, one of the reasons you might want to apply to work in one worker council is you're comfortable with their way of doing this. And maybe one workers council is going to make rather elaborate procedures with an effort rating committee. And how often do you rotate through the effort rating committee, et cetera, et cetera. And another council is going to say, we don't want to do this. We also have talked about, I mean, there are a few collectives that have operated attempting to implement this principle. The one up in Winnipeg and the Mondragon collectives in Winnipeg, Canada, they adopted the idea and they put this into practice for 20 years. And it's one of the things that, you know, we have testimony from members of that committee. It was something that it was always something they were trying to tweak and fiddle this way and that way. It was something that some people felt this way about. And in the end, they came up with something which was not exactly effort rating. It was sort of what they found they were comfortable with was if somebody just is egregiously, you know, not working as hard as everybody else, well, then we'll do something about that. But any attempt to do anything that was a more refined. So we've talked about all of this, and there we are. So I think the major thing I would say is if you take a look at what we actually propose, we say this is something that, you know, the political movement is going to have to be talking about and arguing about in a participatory economy for, you know, for probably decades. But in the meantime, the system can still run because we leave it up to individual workplaces to just do whatever, talk about it and do what you want. In the context of political parties and political movements, you know, discussing, you know, the merits of and the just and the sort of theories of justice behind different ways of going about this.
It's also interesting, like you, Robin, pointed out that as a philosophical question, it's kind of strange as they are a philosophical podcast. And then they just, you know, just straight take it out in a concrete world. You know, how would this really work in a workplace? And conveniently sidestep all the kind of disclaimers, Robin, you just described that, you know, it's a libertarian socialist model. And the libertarian part means that, you know, workplaces obviously are free to run their businesses as they see fit. And that's just something, I mean, I kind of understand it because when we're on the level of, you know, debating ideas, and it just may be easier to build this, you know, framework model of it. But I think participatory economy is practical in a sense that you really have to think about how it work out. But it's a curious, I hadn't thought about this before. It's kind of curious that it's a philosophical podcast and then they sidestep the fairness thing and instead focus on practicality. because the fairness principle on that particular question is actually interesting. Remuneration based on, you know, the value of your production or your, you know, how much you work, or just giving everyone equal pay, does that have some problems and so on? In a philosophical sense, I think it's a very interesting question. I would love to have them here, you know, talk more about that side.
I'm agreeing with both of what you were just saying, Auntie and Robin. I would also lend in like my own personal experience with regards to having been part of collectives and remuneration efforts that have tried to be fair. And a lot of times it's like they tend to be pretty simple. I mean, it's like we can even point to this very podcast as an example. Earlier this month, we're recording this in December 2023. Earlier in December 2023, three of us on this podcast, Auntie, Robin, and myself, as well as two other folks, basically worked out the budget for this podcast for about a year. And we were able to do it in about an hour. And we figured out something that we thought was fair and equitable and worked. And the exact details basically amounted to you're getting paid by the hour. We're assuming if you're involved in effort to help produce the podcast, that would be work that you would be that's productive labor and you should get paid for it. And we just count the number of hours and you're assuming that they're all equal. I mean, to be fair, there's like certain parts of that may be more glamorous or that may be more empowering or less empowering than others. But if we just realized that would be an issue, we would certainly address it, but we felt we didn't have to. So it didn't come up as a concern. Different people and different groups can address this in different ways as they see fit. And in fact, in the experience, kind of like on what Robin had said, of examples of businesses that have tried to implement this, they've more or less adhered to that principle. They worked it out themselves to see what they think was fair and saw fit, and they just did it. And that would be the case within the model writ large.
Right. The Canadians up there in the Mondragon Collective in Winnipeg for over 20 years, they had to talk about it a lot. Mm-hmm. There were disagreements amongst their members, and they settled on what seemed to work best for them. And the South End Publishing House, yep, it was exactly the same thing. That was another collective that went about doing it this way. I mean, the other thing is that I know I used a quote that I think is attributed to Winston Churchill about political democracy. And he's saying something to the effect that, well, there's absolutely no doubt that, you know, democracy is absolutely the worst system of government, except for all the alternatives. Mm. And we've sort of clearly expressed that attitude about this, which is, yes, you can quibble, you can quibble about it, you can argue about it, but we're flexible about, you know, what any group of people decide to be comfortable with. That's what they do. We don't dictate to them. And don't expect it to always feel good. And the other thing that we've said, you know, very, very clearly is, well, one of the things that one should do when looking for a workplace is search for one where you're comfortable with how they handle this. And if you find yourself in a workplace where I've given this example, I thought I got screwed by my own faculty members at American University for decades in terms of reward, because we had a committee that rated our performances, and that was the basis of raise. Well, if you're in a situation like that and you think your coworkers, you know, don't appreciate you, well, then the question is the system one in which it's easy to move? Or is there a huge transition cost to saying, I want to leave this worker council and go find another one? Will I be able to find another one, or will I be unemployed? So then you want to ask, is it easy to move when you're unhappy with this? And we've identified it as one of the things that people are frequently unhappy with when they're in their workplace. They're unhappy with who's getting paid what and how much they're getting paid.
There's one other clip I wanted to play. And Robin and Auntie, I wanted to get your take on this. The folks at the What's Left of Philosophy podcast raised the issue related to whether or not you should set up a dictatorship within a worker council, for example. And also, why shouldn't a worker council behave counterintuitively to undersell its value? The clip I will bring up now, and we'll listen to it for about a couple minutes, and then we'll get your we'll hear what you have to say. So just a moment.
Both increase the efficiency so they have more capacity, like, you know, because you want to have more effort for your plant, for your neighborhood, for like whatever you're doing. But then what if the people in that plant decide like they actually want to undersell their efforts? So like they want to say that they that they're making less of an effort than they actually can, because they want to keep getting the kickbacks that they would get by kind of underestimating what they're able to do. Like, this is the source of Soviet corruption. Like, that's what it is. Like, the state planners had an incentive to do inefficient things.
From what I understand about their model procedurally, is that you wouldn't want to systematically undervalue or undersell your effort or productivity, because that would mean that you get less of a right to the consumptive share.
Consumptive share.
You'd get
less social esteem.
You get less social esteem, and also you'd be able to like consume less shit on that basis, right? I think.
Yeah.
I don't know if that fully works to solve your worry, but I think that's what they'd say.
My issue is almost more of like a discipline. It's almost more of a disciplinary one. Like, one of the things that they say specifically is that this is a better model. Like, the coworker evaluating effort model is better than like bosses or employers evaluating it, because it's easy to trick bosses and employers like into like making it look like you've done a lot, like when you haven't. Like, and I was like, yo, wait, you're gonna take that away from us? Like,
you're gonna take away from us?
Like,
it's one of the only things I have.
And so now I'm gonna have to like fucking work like a dog because everyone around me is watching me and like writing up a report card about my performance. I mean, tricking your boss is like one of the only good things left, good things left to a lot of workers.
Robin, Antti, what do you think?
You know, they've actually in that little clip, they're not talking about one thing only. There's two or three different things. One of them is the woman philosopher. Is expressing something that was a well-known critique.
Yeah, Lillian, but yeah.
Right, Lily. That Lillian's expressing a well-known critique of central planning, which is that in the context of central planning, there was a very perverse incentive for workplaces to try and disguise their true capabilities, because the central planners would then assign them, you know, a work plan that they could very easily carry out. So this is a well-known critique of central planning. What Lillian, at least, doesn't seem to realize is we were well aware of that. We have expressed that critique. I've written extensively about that problem. I think it was, I mean, there were serious problems with the centrally planned system, and certainly serious problems with the totalitarian political system existed in the context of. But I think this was actually, I've identified this as the fatal flaw in central planning. So we're on the same page length. Now, the question is, did we successfully design a planning procedure that overcame this problem? Because we certainly thought so. That was our intent. And if you look at, you know, if you're a worker council, how do you get your proposal accepted? Your proposal for what you want to do. The way you get it accepted is by convincing people that the social benefits of what you're doing are going to be at least as high as the social cost of what it is that you're asking, you know, that you're imposing on society by using resources. So you have a very powerful incentive to claim, you know, to go ahead during the planning process and emphasize how much you can produce rather than how little you can produce. So this is something we really have dealt with. But I think she's very familiar with David Schweikert's model. And he, like many, I mean, there's something where we agree very much with Schweikert in our criticism of the centrally planned, you know, Soviet type economy, that there was this very bad perverse incentive and it's very important to overcome it. But in any case, on that subject, it seems that they just haven't really looked carefully at what we've said on this subject and recognized that, well, yeah, wait a minute, any workers' council that pretended they couldn't do very much, they actually would not get their proposals approved. And then they'd have to figure out what to do.
Yeah. Antti.
Yeah. The other thing is that I just found it funny that you know, when they're saying that, you know, cheating your bosses is the best thing in life, then, you know, if you like that, then you're going to love, you know, capitalism or centrally planned economies, because that's what you get a lot. But you're not going to love libertarian socialist economies, because there are no bosses. But again, in a philosophical sense, it's kind of a strange, you know, mishmash, that, you know, the very concept of not having, you know, bosses at work, the very concept of people organizing their, you know, productive activities together without central coordination within the workplace or otherwise, is something I would imagine that these podcast people find, you know, something worth, you know, maybe even fighting for. I get it. It's a joke. You know, cheating your bosses is wonderful. You know, every extra toilet break you take is, you know, you win a small increase in salary, kind of. That kind of thinking, you know, I like it. But I think Robin is correct that it's...
The other thing that's just quite simple is that, you know, cheating in capitalism, you're cheating a capitalist boss. In the old Soviet economy, you were, you know, cheating the party member who was, you know, the supervisor, you know, in the state-owned enterprise. Well, in this case, you're cheating your fellow workers. And one is, well, are you as inclined to cheat your fellow workers as those other two characters? And the other is, are your fellow workers actually in a better position to know if you're doing it? And we've discussed this sort of, you know, endlessly. I wanted to say that there's two things they bring up, which I think are very good points. And I don't think we claim at this point to have perfect answers to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody mentioned the idea of, well, how exactly does this annual plan finally get approved? Is it unanimity, or is it a majority vote, or is it a supermajority vote? And those are good questions. And they don't get answered in our simulations, because our simulations just sort of make assumptions about what gets approved, you know. Once we get within 5%, then we get to stop. So those are good questions that people have raised. And I think various people, I mean, amongst those of us who sort of advocate for this, for participatory economics, there's not really unanimous agreement on how that would all work out. I mean, for the record, I'm very happy with, a supermajority. And I know that at least Michael is resistant to that. So there's something that they brought up that I think, yes, I mean, that's interesting. The other thing has to do with innovation and concerns that there won't be, you know, sufficient motivation for innovation. And there's something where I think they're as philosophers, they haven't distinguished, they don't realize that we economists distinguish between two different kinds of efficiency. And for to keep it short, we have static efficiency and we have dynamic efficiency. Static efficiency is, are we using the resources we have right now, you know, in the most efficient way? And dynamic efficiency, you know, is whether or not we are getting, you know, do we have powerful incentives to innovate and come up with new technologies and new ways to do things? And we claim to have really good answers to how it is we've now designed our procedures to achieve static efficiency. And that's really what most economists concentrate on, you know, in most of our work. Good economists who study dynamic efficiency teach us that it's very difficult to figure out, you know, what promotes dynamic efficiency and what doesn't. You know, the inventions, innovations, and applying a new theoretical breakthrough in a pragmatic way that increases productivity, all of that is a very complicated process that economists who study it say it's just complicated. You know, it's not as easy to figure out. But we clearly have said on the record, we certainly would not be satisfied with an economy that didn't have a great deal of dynamic efficiency, you know, figuring new, better ways to do things. And what we have proposed is that our reward system, if necessary, we've actually gone on record as saying, if it turns out that people in a participatory economy, first of all, we advise you should constantly be looking to see whether you're getting dynamic efficiency. I mean, you should be watching yourself for that. And if you come to the conclusion you're not, and you're not satisfied with it, and you don't think there's any way around providing material incentives for innovative enterprises, you know, above and beyond efforts and sacrifices they're rewarded for, well, then so be it. If that's what experience demonstrates, then so be it. So that is, we have recognized this problem, potential problem, and we have sort of gone on the record as saying, you know, what it is we would propose or how to handle it. And I don't think they don't seem to be aware of that. I mean, in their discussion, they didn't seem to be aware of what we'd already said on that subject.
I'd like to add that what Robin mentioned about how to come up with a plan and what kind of maturity you need. That's in general sense, that's very, very important for any, you know, if people are advocating for different versions of democratic planning. And even if your ideal society is, you know, mixed economy with, you know, market socialism or what have you, even that kind of economy requires planning actually on many levels, because our current economy also has planning. So you have to have answers to how, you know, how to come up with a plan in basically any economy. And in participatory economy, you obviously have sort of democratic hooks in place. So you have systems of trying out and, you know, coming up with different versions of you know, how to come up with, you know, concrete plan and of what kind of maturity you need, for example, without the kind of sort of very gridlocky political battles that are constantly present in models where, you know, in mixed economies, because that's always case by case cases. Planning, and it's very easy to come up with. But the other thing I'd like to point out that it also just came out to me is that I think one of the beautiful things about participatory economy is that people often come up with these examples that, you know, what if someone disagrees, or what if, you know, some people really want this on the economy? And that's a good thing, I think. And that's something that's often missing from when people are discussing post-capitalism and different models for economy, because I think it's a very important value in itself that our future economy accommodates people with very different views. Because that's, I think, biologically the kind of creatures we are, especially when you go to large scale, which is sort of by necessity you need if you really want to achieve a global economy. And that's sometimes missing from post-capitalist discussion. That is that, you know, people talk about like shared imagination or, you know, wider, you know, acceptance of liberal values or something like that, which kind of sidesteps, I think, the issue that, you know, in any situation, if you have an actual global economy where there are always, you know, opposing interests, some, you know, if you use some productive resource to something, it's not available to some other part of the economy. And that's bound to generate, you know, discussions on, you know, and you have to have decision-making, you know, systems in place. Like Robin actually points out, you have to have answers who gets to say no. And I think that's an example of that. And it's a good thing to bring out. And I hope it's also considered more widely. And, you know, other examples, like who gets to say no in degrowth? Who gets to say no in your favorite model of mixed economy? Who gets to say no in donut economics? Or who, you know, gets to implement the planetary boundaries, right, in that case? So I think it's very important in all accounts.
Okay.
But Mitchell, I want to really thank the What's Left of Philosophy people for doing this episode. I want to thank Travis Froberg for prompting them to do episode number 76. Because I think this is exactly the kind of, you know, fruitful discussion, you know, that moves a project of a better kind of economy forward. So I'd like to thank them very much.
Yeah, and I want to plug, because just by browsing the list of episodes they have here, there's, you know, stuff like what could it mean to say capitalism causes sexism and racism, which is actually one very important aspect where, you know, people should be very critical of capitalism. It actually promotes very antisocial behaviors such as sexism and racism. There's an episode on effective altruism, which I hate, but their episode is effective altruism is terrible, and I like it. That's, you know, just by browsing their list of, you know, they have, oh my God, they have an episode of Hayek. I love that.
Oh.
You know, they have serious good stuff. They're going through, you know, wonderful stuff such as Gramsci. There's, you know, Franz Fanon, you know, I'm from Europe, so I like all this. it's definitely, they've done just terribly good job with this. They have, you know, tens and tens of episodes. They also have episode on utopias. So, I mean, it's definitely, you know, we are a very narrow podcast. We're just talking about participatory economy. So, and who likes that kind of ice cream, you know, loves our podcast. But I mean, What's Left of Philosophy is definitely doing good work. It's amazing to browse their stuff.
The website.
I also want to send a message to Lily that if David Schweiker did not give her at least an A- in that class she took with him, she deserved at least an A-.
The website of that podcast, What's Left of Philosophy, is leftofphilosophy.com. You can check it out there, listen to all the episodes, and more. And this has been the episode. This has been the podcast Pep Talk, the Participatory Economy Podcast, the podcast where we discuss the democratic alternative to capitalism known as a participatory economy. To find out more, visit the website of the Participatory Economy Project at participatoryeconomy.org. There you can join in an online forum where you can discuss anything regarding a model of a participatory economy, including the episode of What's Left of Philosophy to discuss the model of a participatory economy. And you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter that the Participatory Economy Project shares to share updates regarding the project and work on the model of a participatory economy. For Antti in Helsinki and Robin in Portland, this is Mitchell in Chicago. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Please visit participatoryeconomy.org to find out more and subscribe to our newsletter. Thanks, and see you at the next episode.